have been giving some what I think are bold talks on some subjects that are sometimes tippy-toed around. So the last of the bold talks is this topic of dependent origination. And just to tell you a little history about this subject, it's often thought to be the central teaching of the Buddha's doctrine of Dhamma. And it has a colorful history in the suttas and in the commentaries and in that complex last part of the teachings called the Abhidhamma. And it is it's always treated with a lot of caution and care, and so when I undertake it, I undertake it with all humility. The famous story of Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, a Sotapanna, and one who had a superb memory and who had, you know, been with the living Buddha for a number of years, saying one day to the Buddha, you know, I've been contemplating, I know that dependent origination is your central teaching and it's the crown jewel of the teachings, and I've been contemplating it. I find it pretty clear, you know, it's fairly straightforward, and thought about it. The Buddha is saying, do not say so, Ananda, do not say so. This teaching is deep, and it appears deep. If you really had fully understood it, Ananda, you would not be a Sotapanna, stream enter, you would be an Arahant. So, if Ananda had to handle it with kid gloves as well, we all have to. It often does appear fairly straightforward and simple after you work it out a few times. Although it is amazing in history when people get a hold of this, how many variations they can come up with, explanations they can come up with on this. So we start out with that kind of apology at the beginning, that we are handling something that the Buddha himself said, this is a very deep subject and appears deep. And so also, if you have read various views of it and have your favorite kind of interpretation, always remember that, just to not be too attached, because there are other views of it, and you might find something very profitable in another way of looking at it. The essence of dependent origination, or sometimes called codependent origination, is that it is why it's peculiarly Buddhist is that it is an articulation of causality, which sounds simple enough in our day and age when we have a whole scientific vocabulary and appreciate the laws of causality. But it's not all religions are concerned with causality. There's a lot of when people suffer and are desperate, they often turn to a very acausal kind of attempts to really alleviate the suffering, and belief systems that are strangely unrelated to any sort of fathomable causality. And this is the Buddha is describing this kind of a rational and appealing sense of that things happen for a reason, and even our strange irrational behavior is not so irrational when we look at the causes. So things happen for a reason. Why you get angry and resentful, head for the casino and blow all your money. It happens for a reason. It's not lost. It's not whimsical. And so it's incredibly important. I would say that what's truly also important is when you look at these teachings, don't look at them as interesting ideas or intellectual ideas. The true intention of the teaching on dependent origination is it's a therapy. dependence origination therapy, if you take it up as a therapy, you will be in the spirit of its how it was taught. So it very easily can become a kind of an academic exercise. Who has the cleverest explanation for this? But it's not meant for that. It's meant to... one part of the therapy is this. You are now invited to use this causality in a skillful way, and the conviction or faith or commitment to causality is a very relaxing commitment. The mind learns to let go of its future obsessiveness and its goal-orientedness. Now, this is one of the great problems of our society and our time, is that we become obsessively oriented towards goals and the future. And we find ourselves psychologically at in tension with ourselves because we want a certain result to occur. We've not been told that it's unskillful to want a skillful result, to in the sense of inducing internal stress. But whenever it comes to actually teaching things, ordinary activities and crafts and skills in life, a person who has experience with these things is quite familiar with the process of learning and how you anticipate and desire and want and feel somehow that you will get better results if you're highly motivated and want things to happen. And it quite often interferes with the learning process itself. So, a music teacher is very familiar with if a person wants to play the piano well and just comes to the lesson, and then they play the first little part, and then they make a mistake, and then they go, oh darn, and they express frustration, and then they try again, they make the same mistake, oh gee, I don't know what I'm doing. No, the teacher soon says to them, now don't do that. When you make a mistake, I don't want to hear about it. No, just either start again or play through the mistake. And also, if they're a wise teacher, they will say, now, every time you do that, you really waste time and energy. It's not necessary. That is not how you learn to play the piece correctly. The way you learn to play the piece correctly is not even by practice. You heard this expression, practice makes perfect? The real expression is perfect practice makes perfect. Why do you make a mistake? Because you practiced a mistake. I used to be a musician, so I remember the phenomena, feeling somehow my mere sweat and effort would result, even though I was in a sort of hastily practicing, stumbling, and giving myself credit for the 98% of the notes that I played right. I was somehow hoping that the 2% that I would again and again practice wrongly would somehow magically disappear because of the virtue of the 98% I practiced right. It doesn't happen that way. Since I practiced it again and again, the mistake, I played the mistake. Whatever you practice, you will play. And so then I had to relearn to teach myself to practice all over again in the right way, to take enough time to do it right. That's another saying that I experience again and again, even in the monastery. There's never time to do it right the first time. Always time to do it right the second time. So, in this is a learning about causality. I also learn to relax and just take the time to do it right. There's no haste, and you end up with the right product in the end. And that is a great blessing, because you can, in any area of life, now some of you may be good craftsmen, good artists, having learned skills in life, but maybe that isn't one of them that you've learned. Is that, you know, it's actually what you do is gives you the result. It's not the extra dimension of tension and worry and so forth that gives you the result. The Buddha is inviting you to undertake the supreme art and craft of the movement from suffering to well-being, to happiness, which indeed is very similar and not really other than any other art and craft. It involves the same kind of common sense skills that you bring to any learning process. It says, in the same way that you learn these things, and not to invest them with a lot of stress and strain by future orientation, future goal orientation. In the same way, keep your eye on the causes. This is not going to happen magically or mystically. If you put in the causes, the results will appear. If the causes have not been put in, the results can't appear. So if you're experiencing maybe meditation that you're having trouble concentrating, you think it's frustrating, you know, I should be able to maybe I'm not trying hard enough to concentrate. Remember that you're focusing on what is the resultant. Concentration is a resultant. Serenity is a resultant of what? The preliminary causes that go in, and then this concentration, steadiness of mind appear. In ordinary life, you can see this. When you're trying to study for an exam, and you're reading a book, and you get down halfway down the page and can't remember what you read. You go to the top, try again, you get down a paragraph, can't remember what you read, so forth. But after a few times, the wise person diagnoses their problem as something else in life is calling to me, and therefore I'm not able to do this. Maybe what I have to do is do the dishes first. In other words, I'm ill at ease because I haven't taken care of things like the housework, or I haven't paid my rent yet, so I can't do this. So sometimes much more intelligent to put these things aside, go and do whatever preliminaries that you need to do. And then when you come back, it's not a matter of effort. The mind is free from its previous burdens and distractions, and it's now able to pay attention. When you're doing this, you are actually performing a series in the steps of dependent origination. You're going back in a sensible way and asking, what is the cause of this? What is the cause of ease of mind so that I can pay attention, get on with this? Preliminary causes have not been arranged, therefore the results cannot appear. But if you're a certain irrational type, a causal type, you will just sort of furiously sort of knit your brows and stare at the paper, you know, trying to make the results appear without putting in the proper causes. So this is the Buddha is inviting for you to relax, you know, on your way to Nibbana. It's not won by strain, it's not won by tension, it's not won by wishing. Again, the Buddha uses this again and again. It is not by wishing that one walks across town. Now, wishing is, what is wishing? It's a form of tension imposed on oneself, separation from the present. It is by just putting one foot in front of the other. There may be effort involved, but one of the extra efforts that is not profitable is this kind of yearning, wishing, frustration, etc., at wanting things to appear early. The dependent origination, I also, for those who have, you know, read about this, and sometimes, especially I know an audience like this, there's got to be lots of depth of experience and reading. They may have come across two versions of it, or more. One version, which is sometimes insistently held, is that dependent origination, the steps of causality articulated by the Buddha in various places, refer to all taking place in this life, and sometimes in a single kind of moment of this life. And then there's another version of it, which holds that what is meant by sometimes the 10 or the 12 steps of dependent origination is that a way of sketching in the causality that appears over three lives, a past life, how a past life leads to birth in a present life, and how it influences and conditions the beginnings and some of the events of this life, and how this life, in turn, the events, the psychological actions, and reactions to the environment, how that influences and shapes the production of the next life. So, now long articles and essays and whole debates in the religious community have been taking place over this for a long time. And I think there's certainly justification for both views, as either view will do. I think when somebody insists and clings to the idea that there is only one and only one way of understanding this teaching, they may have been forgetting that the Buddha was often using skillful means and expedient means to just get you to the end of suffering, not to worry too much about the grasp at the means to the end. You know, he has that little parable of the man who, or the person, man or woman who makes a raft to get across the other side of a river, and then they assemble this raft out of sticks and logs and so forth. And they get in, they lay their chest on this, and they paddle with their hands and their feet to the other side of the river. They manage to get out on the other side of the river, the raft having helped support them so they wouldn't be swept away. And then he says, now, what should that person do? Should they take that raft, put it on their head and carry it away, or just leave it there? So his listeners said, just leave it there. It's not sensible to be walking around with a raft on your head. Lots of interesting things in this story. That raft is expedient means. Notice that in the way the original telling of this story is often told, and it's just the raft, you know. You make a raft, and they ride across on this raft or something like this. But actually, he gets into a fair bit of detail. It's a very haphazard little bit of business. It's a bunch of sticks and logs, and it's just looped together almost in a hasty fashion, in a rough fashion. And the person lays on it and half swims across, paddling with their hands and feet, and gets this ragged contraption to the other side, which has served to get them to the other side. That's all that matters. Obviously, it's not a beautifully carved canoe or painted boat or anything like that. It's a tacked together collection of things. And then he says, and then he abandons it. Now, that is meant, he explains the simile himself, that the idea is that these are the teachings that will, as long as they give you enough buoyancy, that's all that matters to get you across the river. The river is out of the conditioned world, the samsara, the delusional world, to the other side of the river. And the other side of the river is freedom, the end of suffering. It says, there you do not carry the raft on your head. Now that is, it says, don't cling to the teachings. The teachings are just for getting you across there. They're not for making long debates over or anything like that. They're just cobbled together, stacked together, just whatever will do to get you across there. That's all that matters. Get across there. You know that you don't just drift across, you don't sail across. He paddles with his hands and his feet. The Buddha never says anything casually. Every word the Buddha is the master of similes, one of the great ways of teaching. This is how you know a master teacher. Metaphor and simile. The Pali Canon is the largest, by far, collection of similes, metaphors, images in any religious literature in the world, especially in the ancient world. And each of these similes is a jewel of construction. The hands and the feet are right effort, the four elements of right effort. The effort to uproot unwholesome tendencies that have already occurred, the effort to prevent the arising of unwholesome tendencies that haven't yet occurred, the effort to cultivate and maintain the good qualities that are already there, and the effort to initiate and develop good qualities that have not yet appeared. This is the process of this pushing. This is what propels the raft. Right effort propels the raft across. The raft is just this expedient teachings that bring you to the other side and not to be clung to. After crossing, then you're free. Enjoy it. So that paticca-samuppada, the dependent origination, is just one of these maybe that will help you and buoy you up and help you cross over to the other side. Again, it would be not too skillful to be arguing over the raft or getting attached to it. So, the view should think a little bit about how the Buddha talks about his own discovery of this. He says, "This is my discovery." How is the first sort of appearance of this teaching? It says, "As I sat under the Bodhi tree on the night of my enlightenment, what I first thought of a question came into my mind." And this is the mark of a genius. He asked himself a very simple question. What is the cause of death? You know, we're always asking this in the coroner's report here. It's interesting the difference between Asia and here sometimes. We're preoccupied with knowing exactly what the cause of death was. And I remember asking in Thailand while I was there for 3.5 years as a forest monk, people died. And we wanted to know that. For some reason, Westerners want to know exactly what, why. So the Thais are interesting. They don't quite think the same way we do, and they say, "Well, he just got sick." But, "Well, yeah. I mean, what? Sick of what? You know what? Well, he's very sick. His cause of death was sickness. You know, died because he was sick. And but exactly what was the, you know, what was the sickness? Oh, he was very sick. You know, like, what do you care? He's dead. We had a monk. One of our abbots was a Western monk, and we had a Malaysian fellow come and stay at the monastery who was a monk, and he, a bit mysteriously, he died, and the abbot wasn't sure why, and he felt a little. He thought he wasn't. He had a bit of a fever. He just went off and died. And so he was felt a bit guilty. Maybe he wasn't paying attention enough to what was going on there. Why did he? It was a very bit of a surprise and so forth. So he wanted to know what the cause of death was. Really to alleviate his own conscience, he was feeling a little guilty. All the other Thai monks there who tend to be the local village boys who become forest monks. They didn't have much interest in why he died, but he was dead. But so they took him to the nearest hospital, and of course, the coroner investigates all of these deaths. But they asked him. He said, "Can you do an autopsy on him? Can you, you know, investigate the cause? We want to know why he's dead." And they just looked at him and said, "Well, he's dead. Why do you care? You know, he's dead already. We're not bringing him back, you know." "Yeah, I know we're not bringing him back. I want to know why he died." "Well, why? He's dead already, you know." And it went on and on, back and forth. They couldn't. Why do you want to cut him open and all this? This is a lot of trouble. He was dead, you know. They couldn't understand. Finally, they did it. They did it. And they obviously were very inept at this. This was not their specialty. Because when they put the investigation was it malaria? They cut this open the skull, and then when they put him back together, they put the skull on backwards and sewed him all up. So he appeared in a very peculiar way, and with the little lump at the back of your head in the front. And it was not very. His parents came to the funeral; they were not impressed. But it was a kind of a bizarre, macabre, strange funniness about it all, and surreal quality to it. But they again say, you know, well, it was malaria, but nobody could believe them because I don't think they really cared, and they just told us something that would satisfy us. But this is, so the Buddha asked what the cause of death is. Interesting question. You know, he's not really asking the kind of coroner question, what is the cause of death? Brilliant. So what do you think the cause of death is? His answer was birth. That's the cause of death. No birth, no death, right? You can't. If you're born, inevitably death will follow. If you're not born, no death. And that is the something that you can take to the bank. But interesting the way his mind is working there, he's saying, this is the exclusive, this is the cause that, there are other aspects to do with your life and so forth, aside from birth, but this is the one that can't be removed without removing, the resultant. So when he thinks about what does death depend on, this is the last two links of dependent origination. What does death depend on? It depends on birth. If no being anywhere was born, there could be no death. Do you, everybody agree with that one? Anybody got and feel that that doesn't cover the base solidly enough? That one's pretty hard to disagree with, isn't it? That, and interestingly, he was thinking backwards. Going through this, as he's sorting this out, he was going backwards through from result to cause. When we investigate this dependent origination, we see it just as a kind of a circle. Some ways of presenting it is. By the way, there are a number of ways of presenting this. You may be familiar with the 12 factored way, but there's a number of ways. Right in the canon, sometimes just three sections, 5, 6, 10. 12, and there's even more. Often we start with, when we want to investigate it, we start with avijja, or non-knowledge, or ignorance. And this gives rise to sankharas, in some versions, sankharas. We talked about sankharas yesterday, that to do with volitional formations, intentional actions of the mind. So intentional actions in the mind are dependent upon non-knowledge or incorrect knowledge, or what we might call ignorance. The way we think is based on ignorance. We would provides the conditioning for the rising of consciousness. And we talked a little bit about consciousness the other day too. Consciousness in this case is, I explained there were six kinds of sense consciousness, but this consciousness seems to be, at least in the interpretations of the three life theory, this is called patisandhi vijnana, relinking consciousness, rebirth linking consciousness. People are often asking, what is it that goes from one life to another if there's no self? And this is one of the nature, staples of the Buddha, or actually the word anatta, meaning not self. If there's not a self, what is it that goes from one life to the next? Terminology, and somebody says, oh, it's consciousness that goes from one life to the next. I mean, remember, this is a famous blunder. A man holds, a monk actually, says, oh, it is consciousness that goes from one life to the next. The Buddha says, do not say that. You are misrepresenting me by saying consciousness is what goes from one life to the next. Very interesting. Because even now you'll hear in casual ways people saying, oh, it is consciousness that goes from one life to the next. No, it's not. He says, it's not consciousness that goes from one life to the next. I say now as before, when A is present, B arises. When A disappears, B also disappears. That things do not, there is not a thing going from one point in time to another. It's a series of causal swellings. Like a series of dominoes lined up. When you tip, if first, you know how they line the dominoes up? You tip one, and it knocks into the next one, and that knocks into the next one. First one doesn't end up at the end of the line, does it? First one falls down right here. And then the energy, there's a transference of energy. It's not a thing that's transferred. The energy cannot be held, it cannot be put in a box. It's a continuously changing process. That energy that transferred from one domino to the next is not a thing. It is a flowing process, isn't it? So that's why the Buddha is careful to say, because if he said consciousness goes from one life to the next, you would identify that as your real self. That would be your soul. Consciousness would be the soul. But this consciousness is not a static thing. It's an endlessly and rapidly changing flow process. So what he says, more or less, is that the last moment of consciousness of one life conditions or provides the conditions for the arising of the first moment of consciousness of the next life. It is not that the last moment, that the last consciousness jumps to the next life. It just arranges the preconditions. And then the famous simile of a series of candles, three or four candles on the table here. And the first one I light with a match. And I take the first candle and I light the second candle. I put the first candle back, and then I light the third candle off of the second candle, and I light the fourth candle off this third candle. Now, is the flame from the first candle, did it go there to the fourth candle? Or did it just provide, now you've got the fuel in the candle. If there's no fuel, if there's no wax in there, the candle won't ignite. You provide the conditions through the flame for the appearance of the next flame. That flame didn't go to that candle. It provided the conditions for the arising of the flame in this candle. So that is how the Buddha talks about this process. They're very, very careful. He's very careful about this. And it gives you so that you don't get a strong sense of identity, something unchanging going from one moment to the next, one life to the next, but a series of not disconnected events. You don't want to disconnect these events, otherwise you get no sense of continuity, no sense of identity. When people come, now this is in a sense where rebirth and karma tie in, and the five aggregates tie in. Now, the last two, if you weren't here for the last two nights, I'm not going to explain that again. Those were, you'll have to listen to the tapes. Explained karma and rebirth, and then the five aggregates. So we're looking in the aggregates, what transfers from one life to the other, etc., sometimes comes up. So what the Buddha is saying is, well, I guess obviously the body doesn't go to the next life. The body is there in front of you. It's lying on the ground. So you're left with four factors of mental factors. You're left with feelings. Now, feelings, of course, they disappear right in front of you. You know, you don't have to wait till you die before the pain is gone, the pleasure is gone. They're rising and passing away in a flood all the time. Obviously, there's no identity there. There is consciousness. That is the thing that registers sensation and so forth. And that's in a constant flow. Perceptions are changing all the time. I was just talking earlier about how for perceptions, you can sometimes get fooled about your identity with perceptions. Because you remember that you like apple pie. In fact, you like apple pie with chocolate ice cream. It's a bit weird in your family. You're the only one. And you have all for the last 17 years liked it that way. And that's you, all right. And your family agrees. Yeah, that's you. He likes that. She likes that. So sometimes that's called perception, and that's an overlay of memory and tendencies and habits. Which you sometimes think of as yourself, but that really is changing all the time. I mean, it may have persisted for a number of years, but there's a subtle change in perception. Another layer is always being put on by experience. So there is no real static central self. So sometimes it becomes obvious that there isn't a central static self in this, because some things you used to like, and you used to like it for 12 years, sometimes that's faded out on you, and you're kind of mystified. You know, it doesn't do anything for me anymore. You know, you just loved to go to the movies before, and especially detective shoot-em-up movies, and then something happens in your life, and you've changed the mood, and you go there, and you're anticipating this experience, and it doesn't happen, much to your amazement. Something's been altered, actually, in the flow, in the causal flow of your life. And you didn't even have to try to get that result. Something farther down the stream in the process has been altered. And the result is that, much to your surprise, what is called grasping has been unloosened and fallen away. Now you don't care anymore. It's not that you don't like it. It's just that you used to like it, and now you can take it or leave it. This can happen in all directions. It can happen in increasing like, decreasing like, neutrality, aversion, either you're pushing it away or pulling it towards you. The conditioning process alters, and then you, in a sense, you're in almost a different person, but not quite a different person. That's why the problem of identity over two lives is quite vexes some Western philosophers sometimes, because they how could you really say it's the same person? You know, that the previous personality that they flowed to the next personality, the body didn't go there, and what did go there? What would cause you to identify that person as the same person in the previous life? Now that's what we care. The Buddha would never say that, actually. He said it's not the same person. We call it rebirth. And one, in English, we're kind of careful about this. We often use, they're actually careful about it in the Pali as well, but we, instead of calling it reincarnation, which we casually sometimes use, often the word is rebirth. Reincarnation suggests that something from a previous incarnation, something embedded in the flesh, in the incarnate, jumps out of it, a little unchanging aspect called the soul, and then it jumps into a new body. So you take it up, a little marble or something like that, and you take it out of this doll, and you put it into that doll. That, out of this puppet, and put it into that puppet. And that's, see, that same thing went from one to the next. That would be the notion of reincarnation, where an unchanging soul, the central identity, which is definitely you, and is not subject to fading or passing away, is put into a new container. But from the Buddhist point of view, that's not what happens. That's most definitely not what happens. And the Buddha is he's not just a philosopher. Remember, he never says anything which is not really important to a way of understanding life that definitely affects your psychological attitude, and that increases your happiness and well-being. So whenever you're listening to this kind of talk, don't think it's just a bunch of ideas and philosophy. Remember, as I started, this should be understood as a therapeutic way of understanding what's going on here. When we latch on to an identity, sometimes we can get awfully disappointed in ourselves. We can feel dismayed, and we can feel trapped by ourselves, frustrated by ourselves, and so forth. So it's critically important to one's own well-being that you have you do not have a fixed sense of identity. Otherwise, you're up the creek without a paddle. Because if you don't like who you are, you have this sense of doom. You're destined, that's who you are, and you can't change that. So it's critically important that you do have a vision of that there isn't a real, lasting, substantial, and unchanging self, that it's a fluid flow of processes. And that's what's terribly important, because a lot of hope is in that, a lot of aspiration, aspiration towards well-being and happiness is deeply intertwined with that notion. The second part that's critical to this is that these changes of this flowing process are causal. They happen for very particular reasons. And these reasons can be understood by the ordinary person and utilized and harnessed to get you where you want to go. Now, when I use the word you and I, some people say, well, how come you're talking about you and I if there's no substantial entity? It's just the nature of language, just a noun. Don't take it too seriously. We use, just for the ease of communication, we use nouns all the time. It's not exactly a perfect description of reality the way it is, but it works. It's good enough. So remember, this is not abstract information or even high intellectual kind of information. It's fairly straightforward, but what it involves is harnessing it in your own sense of your inner being, so that you harness it skillfully. Because things like perception, you can alter by altering the causal process. You get very nice results down the road. And remember, you don't have to bring a lot of tension to the process of getting to the place. You don't have to focus or fixate on the typical thing. You're on a drive with the kids and they say, when are we going to get there? When are we going to get there? When are we going to get there? We'll get there when we get there, So just watch out the window. You won't get there any faster by wanting and wishing and hoping. So this is process. But we ourselves become kids sometimes too. When am I going to get that promotion? When am I going to retire? When am I going to do this? When am I going to do that? It's like the kids. It's all has to do with causality. If you drive in the right way, put your foot on the gas, you get the gas, all of these processes go on, you will get to the place. And that when you learn to trust that in a wise way, the whole trip becomes a lot more relaxing. You get there when you put in skillful causes. So in this discussion, I'm going to say that this kind of just addressing this topic of dependent origination could go on for 10 or 12 talks, but I'm going to just stick with the main sort of useful therapeutic principles of it. An area that I want to look at traditionally in the suttas explanation of this, often the and also the commentaries, the traditional commentaries, they will talk about where you want to put your eye on this series of interlinked causes. And one of the places you want to keep your eye on is between contact, that sensory contact, that is when your eye sees something, your ear hears something, you smell something, etc. That contact, and what follows that, the immediate thing that follows that, your reaction to the sense data. If you want to really alter your future, who you are becoming, the process of who you are becoming, that is one of the critical areas to throw a little something into the river, or to rearrange the rocks in the river so that the stream downstream, it's all the flow and the current is all changed and altered. So that's one of the places where you want to keep an eye on. And that, of course, that's why we practice things like mindfulness, because this reaction to what you see happens very rapidly. And there's a little hand inside. You can imagine, as a cartoonist would illustrate, this little hand that reaches out of your head and grabs the object almost automatically. Grabs the object, it looks at the object, not letting it out of its grasp, and then it holds it tighter and tighter and tighter. These are the three links in this process. That is contact, grasping, clinging. The object comes up, a feeling follows it. The feeling itself is where is pleasant. Remember, we were talking about feelings the other day? Pleasant, neutral, painful, And you usually like the pleasant ones, don't you? That's the one you reach for. Or the painful ones, the one you reach to shove away. So this next two steps are reaching and grabbing. And this is how they describe it in the simile. When the hand of a person wants to get something, they reach out. That's the first step. And then they grasp, second step. The tanha, the desire to reach out. And then the upadana is the grabbing. That's those little stages, four little very important steps. Contact. You can't get interested or any sensation coming from until you have contact. Contact is made. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. Mind contact, mental contact. A feeling follows it, and then a response, reaction to the feeling. And it's this at this point, between feeling and reaching, that it's possible to just alter that little reaction there. Most people, it never occurs to the ordinary person to interfere in that process. The automatic, I like, you reach. I don't like, you push away. Both of those, by the way, this is something that sometimes is a big confusion for people. Both grabbing and pushing away is what we call attachment. This becomes confusing because a lot of people, the word attachment for them means holding. It doesn't mean pushing away. So somebody is attached to heroin. That's like, we can understand that. That's attachment. But you don't like your neighbors. You're attached to them. You're in a war with the neighbor over something. You're attached to them. That's what we also refer to aversion and liking as both attachment. You're both attached in both directions. Sometimes stronger attachment. Relationships that are based on hate often last longer than those based on love. There has come to a real terrible peak. There, it's not just one generation. It's going on for generations and generations. Hatred is a powerful way to bind yourself to another person. mere liking often falls away before hatred. This is where we can interfere with the process. Of course, it's not just one generation. It's going on for generations and generations. Hatred is a powerful way to bind yourself to another person. mere liking often falls away before hatred. This is where we can interfere with the process. Of course, we're describing here what are called the hindrances. Hindrances are the food of trouble. They're also, the food of our lack of knowledge, because it appears to us, we grab and we push away because it appears very obvious that we should. And that appearance of should, what seems common sense to us, obvious, indisputable, that's what we call delusion. It's or in the Pali, avijja. So this is a parallel link in the chain. Now, I haven't even described all the chains, and I won't, but because you can look at a chart and so forth, it's important that I just describe a few therapeutic kind of aspects to where you should address this. The link, this parallels the link between feeling and tanha grasping is a parallel to what comes before avijja. Normally, when you look at the 12-fold factor, you know what comes before avijja? Who knows? There's a chance for somebody to get an A in this class. What comes before avijja in this 12-fold circle? What do you see before avijja? Death, yes, you see death. And is the cause of ignorance death? No. That's where it's a peculiar thing to place it in a circle like that. It misrepresents things. Remember what the Buddha said? You know, what is the cause of death? Birth. Indisputable. You feel like, yeah, I get that. So if you say, now, the Buddha sat down, now, what is the cause of ignorance or misknowledge? Death. What? Why would you, where does that come from? There's no link there at all. There's no link. Actually, there isn't a link between death and avijja. Death is not the cause of ignorance. What is the cause of ignorance, really? What does the Buddha say? Somebody asked him this. Since, you know, they're very interested in this doctrine, and it occurred to them, but what's the cause of avijja? Because he often starts explaining it from avijja. What's the cause of avijja? Avijja, by the way, is identical to the word gnosis, or knowledge. And avijja is exactly the word ignorance. And not in a deprecating way. Not ignorance as you're an ignorant. So it's simply absence of correct knowledge. It's you got to remember, it's not just the absence of knowledge, it's the absence of correct knowledge. What in fact is present is the presence of misknowledge as well. This is sometimes the simile for this avijja is often a blind man tapping along with a cane. He's walking towards a ditch. You just feel it when you see the little illustration. You say, watch out, you're walking towards, going to fall in the ditch. That, of course, he doesn't want to fall in the ditch, does he? He's actually in concern with his own well-being, but what is presenting him to his senses, to the limits of his senses, he is trying to keep himself safe. He's trying to go where he would like to go, but because he's lacking in sight, he may go where he does not wish to go, which would not be good for his well-being. That is the spirit of this word avijja. Just think of it as a lack of, just simply missing a faculty of sight. You have no intention of messing up your life or doing anything or an injury, but you are walking towards something that will cause that, entirely not to your liking. But simply an absence without any ill will involved. Something is missing. That avijja, what precedes that? What feeds avijja? The Buddha says the five hindrances are the food of this avijja. This is another place where you can deal with this chain of causality and cut the chain of causality. You recognize the five hindrances are desire, ill will, agitation, sloth or lack of motivation, energy, and doubt. So you can think of it as directions. Desire is pulling the world towards you. Aversion is pushing it away from you. Agitation is floating up. Heaviness is floating down. And then doubt is just going round and round. So you've got the four directions covered, and then that one that just, like a fly that wanders like this, goes all directions. That's doubt, the last one. Doesn't know which direction to go. Those hindrances actually can be dealt with. The blindness itself cannot be perceived directly. I was mentioning this before. The blind man cannot see his own blindness. It's actually more like a defect of sight, where you have a blind spot in the eye. When you have a blind spot in your eye, you do not notice the absence in the room. You only notice that you see the room as whole. In fact, I believe that everybody does have a blind spot. Maybe an optometrist or something can correct me on this, but I believe that everybody, if you really test it, if you move across there, there's a certain part of the eye that cannot directly see, but you don't notice it. Part of the room is missing. You notice that? If you carefully test it, you take a pencil and move it across your eye like that, you will see that it disappears and reappears. Just there's a very small little area in the field of vision that you are not seeing. But you don't realize that you're not seeing. All it seems to you is that you're seeing. You can't see the unseen. This is why avijja cannot be dealt with directly. Delusion cannot be dealt with directly, because it is absolutely presents itself as complete reality, a normal reality. You can only deal with the fuel. That's how are you going to get rid of your delusions if you can't see it directly? That's why it's the most difficult. You know, you hear greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed, hatred, and delusion. Favorite Buddhist saying. What is the cause of problem in the world? Greed, hatred, and delusion. The Buddha says greed is a lesser stain, but very difficult to get rid of. Anger or ill will, hatred, is a great stain and easy to get rid of, easier to get rid of. Delusion is a great stain and very difficult to get rid of. Interesting. The greed and hatred are in a different category. The hatred is fairly easy to get rid of. Reason why? The hatred is unpleasant. So you're motivated. It's pleasant. You're highly motivated to get rid of it. It arises with unpleasant feeling. Vedana, you naturally want to get rid of your anger. You're all for it. It's very unpleasant. The greed, though, doesn't cause so much trouble in the world. You know, you form whole societies like the chocolate cake society and the wine tasting society and so forth. You actually celebrate your own greed. You know, you give prizes and blue ribbons for being the greediest person in the club and so forth. You know, the one who loves this and loves that the most. So, its problem is it rises with pleasure. It's pleasant. It arises with a pleasant feeling beside it, and it's hard to give up the pleasure. You know, things would be better, your life would be simpler, you wouldn't spend so much, you wouldn't tap out the old Visa card and so forth, but it's such a pleasure, very difficult to get rid of because of that. It's not because you can't see it that you don't know it. It's because one is pleasant, the other one's easier to get rid of because it's unpleasant, but the last one, the delusion, problem with it, it's very problematic, destructive. This delusion is the root of wrong views, which are the cause of these nice little wars we have. Why do wars happen? The main reason is the fundamental misperception of reality, delusion. But you can't see it. That's why it's so hard to get rid of. You can't see it. How do you deal with your delusion? How do you get rid of this? This is the hardest thing, the Buddha says. The hardest thing is to see what you can't see. You know, to deal with what your own lack of ability to see. He says, don't deal with it directly. You deal with its food. And that's part of this idea of dependent origin. It depends on something. Let's cut off the food lines to it. This is what they do in wars, too. You encounter a big citadel with big high walls. They're all inside there, armed to the teeth. What do? Storm them. No, you can't deal with it that way. You know that they live on food, eh? And of course, that was the old style of warfare. You don't deal with, you don't try to knock down the walls. You just cut off the food supply. And eventually it gives up. What is the food of delusion? The five hindrances of food of delusion. Those you can see. You can see greed, hatred, agitation, sloth, and doubt. And you can deal directly with them, weakening, so forth. So that's how you bring the first of this first initiation of avijja, which all the chain of causality follows that. If you cut that chain, everything falls apart. You know, if you're chained to the wall in a prison, you don't have to cut every link, you just have to cut one. When you cut one, you're gone. So you cut any of those links in the link of dependent origination. They all depend on each other, they all fall. All you got to do is cut any one, and then you're free, you're gone. They all are tumbled after that. So there are a number of prescriptions for how to cut the various links. But those are two of them where we interfere. When we saw those down, all of the things that follow will be altered. I've talked for an hour. about this. And of course, it's just scratched the surface. I'm sure some of you will not even be familiar with the 12 links. It's not important. You can easily get a little chart or a nice little picture. It's good to have on your fridge, you know, dependent origination with some interesting illustrations of each one. And start to meditate, think about it and ponder it. But what's important is the therapeutic approach to it. Don't leave it as an interesting abstract kind of idea. Just try to get a hold of a few of these things and really employ them. And you will start to feel it, pleasant surprises. It's a way of giving yourself some pleasant surprises. If you interfere right here, down the road you will start to get nice surprises. That's the nature of the mind. If you don't, and you cultivate unskillful habits here, you'll get some not pleasant surprises down the road. Unpleasant surprises. There's a part of our mind that's concealed from us. Like if I asked everybody here, what would you do if suddenly two men ran through the room with guns, shooting at each other? What would you do? If you're 12 years old, you say, I'd jump up and take the guns. But if you're growing up, you would say, I don't know. And that's the truth, isn't it? You've had experiences where weird things happen, sudden big surprises, strange events occur. And what is so strange is that you're surprised at what you do. You think, I just might be really nervous about it. I just don't. But in the situation, you're suddenly cool as a cucumber, and your tongue is silver, you say the right things, you do. Or you're all ready to deal with the situation, you'll get all trembly and shaky, your knees give way on you, and you pass out. You know, what was that? I didn't know what that. That's a peculiar bit of business. I'll just tell you one story to close this about that. Surprises, the nature of not knowing yourself. And how it's really not too good to walk through life with a lot of varied surprises, especially unpleasant ones. This doctor, he told me this story. He was a doctor in Los Angeles, charity ward. And this was back in the early 80s. And he had been practicing about 15 years at that time. And, you know, doctors really deal with a lot of messy stuff. And most of us don't want to look at and deal with. But he said, you know, I could deal with any kind of, you know, motorcycle accident and put my hand inside somebody's body and tie up a little leaking this and that and then sew them up and go for a hamburger, right? You know, quick, get a nice bite and go back and do the whatever. And handling all these terrible things and difficult situations, you know, it just becomes part of your life. And he was on the AIDS was just becoming a bit of an epidemic in that area at the time. You know, you can imagine the Los Angeles charity ward, that was just a hotbed of the new AIDS epidemic. So all these AIDS patients coming in there. And they're just still exploring how hard is it to get AIDS. I know from contact and fluids and stuff, there was a lot of misinformation going around and nobody knew it. And he suddenly thought on his rounds, you know, I hope I haven't picked up AIDS. It'd be a shame. I wouldn't want to go around and give it to all my patients, you know, from handling all of these in contact here. I better get a blood test. So he just went over to the nurse at the station, nursing station, and said, call a friend of his, another doctor, Dr. Brown. Call Dr. Brown on the PA, just get him to come down here and take some blood. And I sent over to the lab. I just want to make sure that I haven't picked up AIDS along the way. And so the nurse announced, and typical in these wards, you know, the doctors are all overworked and you can't get a doctor. And so he's sitting there waiting for the doctor, and he can't. And he realized, I gotta get on with this. I can't wait here forever. So he says to the nurse, I don't know why I even called him. Just give me the syringe and the needle, and I'll take my own blood, and you send it off to the lab. So he sat down there, he put the tourniquet on, took the Vacutainer, you know, the little, just put it in there, and it filled up with blood. And when he pulled it out, there was a little bit of blood that came out, like that, and he just fainted. Down he went. Lost consciousness and cracked his head on the nice concrete floors that they have in hospitals. Woke up in a hospital bed. And he, what the heck happened there? Well, doctor, you saw a little bit of blood. You fainted. What? You know? Well, the thing was, it was his blood. And he was most surprised. He had no idea that he had any fear of needles or the sight of his own blood or anything like this. This took him by complete surprise. And this this led him on to investigating himself. He said, I'm a stranger to myself. I didn't even know what's going on here. He became a meditator. And I was talking to him 6 or 7 years later. He said, this was a great lesson. And, you know, it's dangerous to live as a stranger to yourself. You must know yourself. And this is the nature of that screened level of the mind that you can get to. You can uproot it. What is that? Why did he faint? The power of the idea of it's me. It's a way different when it's you and when it's them. Very, very different. You're identifying with self. You may not realize how deep that sense of self goes. That's bubbling right up out of the unconscious of that which is not available to us. Surprise, doctor. Okay, so I'll leave that as the talk for tonight. And I'll try to answer just the remaining questions that from the other days, but I'll invite also any other written questions from tonight's talk. And do stretch your legs for 5-10 minutes, and we'll just finish off with a few questions. Talk that just a few points that I just want to remind you of, that, and I think which is part of all the talks, that they're all for the purpose of reduction of suffering, both in the world and in your personal life. And the teachings of the Buddha, again, are stated by him for just that purpose. And the material and the way you present it and so forth is is only incidental. And that the idea of coming to the end of suffering involves a conviction of that you can do something about it. That there is, that it rises because of causes, and that goes to cessation by causes. And what's necessary in order to put in the right causes is you understand what underlies suffering and what is the most, the rapid, the quickest and most efficient way to bring it to an end. So those are like all the discourses of the Buddha and all the talks that I gave and so forth are with those things in mind. There's a little, okay, there's a little bit of the common rebirth. I have no issue with betting on the important notions of karma and rebirth, but I feel uncomfortable with the idea that I need to act in a certain way, the Noble Eightfold Path, in order to achieve a better next life or be punished for the poorer rebirth. It is possible or likely that my assumptions do not follow, since my exposure to this issue is largely from Stephen Batchelor's book, Buddhism Without Beliefs. An ironic title, don't you think? Buddhism Without Beliefs. Remember that title. Can you talk about why one needs to watch intentions in this life to experience joy and compassion, for instance, rather than for a rebirth payback? We're talking about quality in this life. We're not saying, the Buddha is very much saying, get on with it. It's not a pie in the sky kind of, you know, remember that little phrase? A critique, in a sense, of Christianity, of that the it'll all be all right when you get to heaven. In the meantime, it's a veil of tears, a valley of tears. you just have to have faith that it's your beliefs will be rewarded in the afterlife. In the meantime, there's very little evidence in this life that that's the case. So the Buddha is saying there can be a lot of evidence in this life that you're on the right track. In fact, he's saying, well, if it doesn't turn out that there's anything in the next life, then this is still a very profitable way of increasing joy and ease and such divine emotions as compassion, etc. You, in fact, should experience them in this life. It doesn't take that long for results to occur. And it's not about putting it off to the next life, always the next life. People who have practiced can have direct evidence of the efficacy of these practices. So it's not a matter of speculation, of metaphysical speculations about the next life or some other dimension of being. It is too much, in a great way, you can experience a lot of these things directly for yourself in this life. And remember, the Buddha was saying, well, you know, if it turns out that that you die in the end and there is nothing afterwards, well, I mean, first of all, you know, it's not likely that you're going to protest the matter after you die and it turns out you don't exist. So he's saying it's a profitable way to live now, and if you've made a bad bet, then you won't have made a serious mistake. And I'll just come back to this business about Stephen Batchelor's book, Buddhism Without Beliefs. And I don't want to advertise the book, but because I don't agree with it, but it's an interesting, almost an inevitable book. And it came out, oh, I don't know, 10 years ago. And it's, I'm surprised that it didn't come out earlier. It's a very typical reaction. It is an attempt to, he has problems with the idea of rebirth, because it sometimes involves a disputation with his, with people's, the viewpoint of the West, which is not, doesn't usually involve rebirth. But he's also influenced by people from the 19th century, Charles Darwin and Thomas Huxley and a few people, kind of a growing movement in that period of time called agnosticism, who prefer to take up the notion that it's important to have a conviction in not knowing, that what you know is that you don't know, and that's all you know. So, but that, and that sounds like a safe place to be, doesn't it? Like, oh, I just don't know. And I'm not budging one way or the other. I just don't know. But in a sense, the Buddha's saying, I'm not interested whether you know or not. So I'm asking you what you know. I'm asking what you believe. And belief and knowledge are two different things altogether. You can't get out the as I mentioned the other day, you don't step out the door in the morning knowing. You step out believing. Convictions, the best of your ability given the facts available, and now jump. And that's the situation you're in. It's not, you can't, you sit back. How much time do you have before you know? You're continuously thrust in the world, having to make choices, whether you like it or not, way before you know it. So the Buddha is talking about that. The idea of agnosticism, I just don't know, and that's the proper position. Well, that's not the way anybody lives. It's a very, a very false kind of philosophical notion, because all your actions do not correspond with that espousal. And the Buddha is not saying you have to say you know, or you do. And that may be in some religions, they're asking you're to be absolutely convinced before you know, etc. The Buddha's not even asking for that. He's saying it's a matter of sort of assessing the evidence and making the best decision you can with what you know. And that decision will not be based on final knowledge, it's just that you have to make some decisions. And some of them, he evaluates them, and what would be the best way to go that would be least injurious if you were wrong, and the most profitable if you turned out to be right. So that's all he's saying. And you're in that situation. So the argument about by Stephen Batchelor is also that where it really goes seriously off the track is that he tries to suggest that the Buddha didn't believe in reincarnation or rebirth and karma, and that that was the conventional beliefs of the time. And in a sense, I started my talk on this by showing you how ridiculous that is. Anybody, any fair-minded person reading the sutta will very clearly understand that the Buddha is not casually mentioning this. This is the central doctrine of Buddhism, indispensable to Buddhism. It is not a side effect. Now, there are things that are in there that are just casual. The Buddha really wasn't interested in what we would call scientific knowledge. He says very clearly, I'm not interested in truth in general. I'm really not interested in truth in general. It can be a great waste of time. There's lots of truths that don't matter. What I'm interested in is in truth in particular, and one thing in greatly in particular, the truth that would lead to the end of suffering. That's the truth I'm interested in. All of the worldly knowledge about how far it is to the moon and why gravity works and things like that is just not interested in. So some of the cosmology that he uses, he talks about, you know, dragons under the sea that are 500 miles long, it's over there. Why does, you know, for instance, what is mentioned by the Buddha and a common belief at the time is why we have eclipses of the moon and the sun. The explanation for an eclipse of the moon and the sun was that a creature known as Rahu, who is a sort of a dragon about, immense, 200,000 miles long or so, and a big belly, he takes a notion every now and then to swallow the moon or the sun, and then he gets it in his mouth and it goes dark, and then everybody panics. The devas who inhabit the moon, the angels, the spirit beings who use the moon as their kind of the base, or the sun as their base, they get a little bit nervous about this. Sometimes they come to the Buddha and say, it makes us nervous when Rahu attempts to swallow the moon. Makes everybody else nervous too. I notice in all cultures that don't have the idea of an eclipse, they often have types of ceremonies and so forth to it makes them nervous. And then in Asia, I think even to this, especially in villages, sometimes one of the things you do is you come out with pots and pans and firecrackers, beat them loudly, and fire the crackle of firecrackers, maybe fire a pistol or two. The noise might scare Rahu off from his business of swallowing the moon or the sun. So the Buddha mentions this business of Rahu because people come to him and say, what should we do when Rahu attempts to swallow the moon? He says, take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, have faith. Follow the five precepts. Virtuous behavior is the best remedy to this. So he does not advocate beating on pots and pans. He says that one must loudly, in a sense, protest this action by Rahu. It's also explained that even though Rahu thinks he can swallow the moon, actually he can't. The moon is moves through the sky by a principle, and the karma of the moon devas and so forth is so powerful that it would go right through Rahu's body if he doesn't back off. This I've puzzled over for a long time. I thought, this is interesting. This is very obviously not very scientific. And did the Buddha believe this or what?
I noticed that he doesn't dispute those kind of things. I think he knew very clearly they would waste his time roaming all over India trying to dispute this, which would be greatly hotly debated back and forth. You waste a lifetime trying to get this across. Remember just establishing that the earth wasn't flat in Europe. That took a lot of, holy mackerel, that was a big thing. How about establishing that the earth is not 6,000 years old? That, in the U.S., remember, some people still hold the conviction that was created 6,000 years ago. But these are distractions, not to be fiddled with. What the Buddha does very cleverly, he takes any of these physical beliefs and he just adds on, well, the best reaction is to improve your virtue, you know, trust your virtue, have confidence in the teachings of the Dhamma. I also believe that there's a secret political meaning to all of this. I don't know whether you ever really thought about it. I remember this, the moon represents in Buddhism, especially the full moon, represents light and sanity. And so the moon represents full enlightenment. Full moon represents full enlightenment. The moon, the mind fully illumined. Sun also is sometimes the representative of the Buddha's mind. Light, of course, we all like light. It's beautiful, radiant, like an enlightened mind. When an eclipse represents actually, in the personal terms, fear, and the eclipse of reason and the pure and fearless nature of the mind by darkness, forces of darkness. On the personal level, it's kind of insanity, irrationality, fearful emotions. And we use the term the dark side of the moon for insanity. And lunacy has to do with the moon as well. Lunacy. It's connected in our at deep level with sanity and insanity. It's a blessed, radiant, soft light. It illuminates things. So the response of the Rahu swallowing the moon is to do with occasionally on a social and political level is that occasionally a nutty king will get in power, a nutty government will get in power, and you must have a revolution. Rahu has swallowed the moon. I tried to swallow the moon. Darkness has come upon the culture. And what are you to do? The response is that everybody in the society has to make a noise to protest this insanity, this darkness. That is the secret meaning of the protest against Rahu swallowing the moon, is that you must voice your disapproval and you must take refuge, and it's not a violent thing, it's take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, Sangha, and virtue. There's virtue and the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, confidence in these teachings that are sanity against insanity. And it's mentioned that these temporary occlusions and overwhelmings of light occur from time to time. Have faith that these are momentary and cannot really, that Rahu cannot really swallow the moon. It appears, and if he really makes a sincere effort, it comes out right through his body. It appears again. Sanity comes back based on virtue. So you have this, and I think in Chinese culture, something called a moon cake. You have it throughout Thailand as well. Maybe, I'm not sure, the other Asian countries, a moon cake, have you? And that's on a certain religious festivals, you have a moon cake. I don't know where in Sri Lanka they have this moon cake. Very delicious, rich dessert. In the center of the moon cake is a egg yolk. And that egg yolk represents the moon. And it is said that at the initiation of this was a secret way of starting a revolution. When the moon cakes are delicious religious food, and in China they had to revolt. And secret signal was that the bakers when they put the full egg yolk in the center, when you broke your moon cake open and you found that the full moon in there, that the revolution has started. The moon cake. So that ever after symbolizes a secret way of communicating about the nature. Now it's time for the full moon to appear, the moon to come back. It's been obscured. So interesting, strange, deep. But whenever the Buddha is talking about his mere sort of physical notions about the world and so forth, he always transforms it into a moral teaching. He really isn't interested in physical, scientific truths. He's interested in how can I transform this. Whatever story he gets, he always makes it into a parable about morality, how it applies to morality. So in terms of the physical workings of the world, it's not to be taken seriously. The Buddha didn't take them seriously. He didn't think there was, but he didn't make the mistake of arguing about it, because that's just distracting everybody. He just, whatever you say, I turn it into Dhamma. But as far as rebirth and karma, that is not just irrelevant scientific ideas. That is inseparable from the notion of causality and power in your own life, empowerment in your own life, that you can go where you want to and make yourself as you wish to, and that you can alleviate suffering. So that's why it's intrinsically important. The other aspect is, can you be, you know, a nihilistic view, can you be happy anyway? I've tried them both. I used to be a nihilist. I mean, that was the reasonable thing to be. And I didn't feel too good. And I don't believe you can. I believe it's an intrinsic aspect that affects the psychology. You cannot free yourself from the sense of a slight dizziness, a sense of absurdity, when you feel that there is no cause and effect, and there is no persistence after death or before death. There's a lack of sense in the moral dimension, and this tends to cause all kinds of sort of inner dizziness. That's the way I experienced it. People may deny it, but I'd have to have them try the other system before they can make a fair comparison. So in other words, they'd have to take on the conviction of rebirth and karma and the meaningfulness of every single moment and act of their life that has repercussions and meaning, and then see if they want to go back to the old one, which one they prefer. The good karmas now negate the effect of bad karmas in previous births. If not, how can one best deal with the fruits of bad karma of previous births? Good karmas, no, they don't negate the effect of bad karmas. You can do good, and then lots of people, there are some very good people, and that have to, obviously in this life, that bad things happen to them. Now, when I say good and bad, I'm using kind of simplistic language here, almost childlike language. I can make it all very sophisticated for you, but I just want to get the rough, basic idea across. And I think everybody knows what we're saying. Unwished for, unwanted things happen. So the theory of karma, again, is black. You do some good, and then you do some bad. And they don't mix together, and the black and the white don't mix together and become gray. That's why you see quite a lot of polarity in people's lives. When they go from tragedy to comedy, back to tragedy to comedy, there's wild swings in people's lives, amazing disparities. If all of these things combine, you would tend to see a much more sort of evenness in life, but you see polarity. You also see people who have a lot of white, sort of positive things, and everything seems to come to them in a beautiful way. Material wealth, all kind of beauty, material wealth, but not necessarily vanity. You know, you can be beautiful and not vain, and so forth, and wealthy and not stingy or a power manipulator or anything like that. Beautiful you know, the material things come to them, and at the same time they can be a noble character as well. You use them quite well. And then you get people who, it's just one terrible black disaster after another, bad things happen to them, and they themselves are insane and twisted and destructive. So you can see this vast, extreme polarity in individual lives, and you can also see a kind of checkerboard in even within an individual life, a checkerboard. In fact, I think the checkerboard, the chessboard, was a religious symbol originally. A Zoroastrian symbol of black and white, and how you move through black and white through that. Interesting. I won't go on too much. These were the, what are the questions from tonight? These were the ones. Okay, that was. When you said 12 steps or whatever it was, what are they? I'm cleaning up the grammar here. Are there charts? Yes, there are. And I won't go into what they are, because you would forget. And it's easier to just get the chart, look it up, because obviously if I just breeze through it, it won't mean anything and it won't be a good use of time. But so I just wanted to take a few of the steps and extract them, because this is the way the Buddha teaches it. He doesn't teaches it. Very rarely does it present this in the full 12 forms. He keeps presenting it in versions of 6s, 2s, 3s, 5s, 10s is a popular way. So it's obviously meant to be taken apart, used whatever's profitable. You can use it in those ways. Of course, I presented, in a sense, more than 12 steps by introducing that something precedes avijja. And there's things that precede the five hindrances as well. What is the cause of the rise in the five hindrances? Every time you ask, it's all causal, there must be something that precedes the five hindrances. Ten fetters? Good try, not right. Huh? Five khandhas? Good try, not right. But the hindrances are based on unwise attention. Ayoniso manasikara. Before the hindrances arise, you have to pay attention in an unwise way, a distorted way. Before ill will arises, a misdirection of attention towards the fault, negative aspect, has to grow. And then you see that the fault is as big as a signboard, and you don't see anything else. And then the fault, because it's such a fault, you become aversive towards it, anger. Or unwise attention to the beautiful. You become infatuated with your girlfriend, because she's just perfect. All you see is the beautiful eyes and the beautiful hair and the this and the that. And that's not all there is to her. But you see nothing but the beautiful. You don't see the whole picture. Later on, 6 weeks later, the rest of the picture starts to come into play. And then you wonder what you've been doing. So the hindrance of lust arises because of unwise attention to just the beautiful and nothing else. And that of course has a cause too, you know, unwise reflection. Unwise reflection is based on not having good information, not having given ear to get good information. Not good information, that is, it never occurs to you that this is what's going on. You never heard of it before. You're in love and you're in love. Or that person is terrible and there's no two ways about it. And you have never heard that there's there's interesting causes why that occurs, and it's unprofitable and so forth. So you don't have correct information. Why don't you have correct information? What's that based on? Not having associated with wise people. So on and on it goes, and interlinked back and forth in an interesting mess. I mean, I think that when you examine these are common sense. These are part of what we would say, okay, why is the kid like he is? Well, he never got a good education. Why didn't he get a good education? He wasn't living in the right place. Why wasn't he living in the right place? The lack of, you know, concern for him. So he fell through the cracks and so forth. And he was associating with the wrong people. He ran in the streets and the alleys, and then they taught him this, and he never heard that you weren't supposed to act that way, and that's why he's in court today. So that lawyers often defend their clients by the teacher Samapada. Defendant origination. Well, there's... Okay. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned...